Hi, this is Chris Kepler with Does This Happen to You? The podcast where we explore the more bizarre ways of getting through your day. This week, we have two stories by Pam Grimes, who you'll find on Medium.com. And here is Working Class Dog. Take Your Dog to Work Day was an ill-conceived idea born of equal parts hubris and red wine. I live in Portland, Oregon, where people take their dogs everywhere, from strip clubs to the symphony to the office. So naturally, I was game to try it with our Kayshawn, Inca. Of course, the majority of dogs in the workplace are well-trained service animals. Inca is neither well-trained, nor does she provide any kind of service. Unless barking neurotically at squirrels and terrorizing delivery men is considered a service. Basically, Inca is 200 pounds of goofy wedged into a 40-pound bag. I work part-time for my husband, who operates a startup incubator in downtown Portland. His clients are all dog lovers, so I assumed they'd enjoy seeing Inca, and she'd love the stimulation of a bustling downtown environment. It was a win-win, so what could go wrong? Like I said, hubris and red wine. The morning of Operation Take Your Dog to Work Day, we loaded Inca and her gear into the back seat of our minivan and headed downtown to my husband's offices in the Union Bank Tower, or as I call it, Stonehenge. When the tower opened in 1969, it was the tallest building in Portland, and the green slate used throughout was said to have come from the same quarry used to build Stonehenge. Impressive digs for our working-class dog. As we pulled into the parking structure beneath the building, I experienced my first qualms. Inca might have been a sweet dog, but was she Stonehenge-worthy? After a quick detour to a nearby bush, we headed back into the building. The qualms I'd had in the parking garage were magnified when I saw the dark trail of wet paw prints on the slate floor behind Inca. My inner voice whispered, "Mistake!" But I ignored her. She can be such a bitch. As we entered the elevator, a posh-looking businesswoman slid in beside us. She looked us over, offering a curt nod, and then her gaze fell on Inca. As the woman took in Inca's damp, disheveled coat and grinning wolfy face, her eyes grew wide. "She's very friendly," I assured her. But Posh didn't reply. She merely flattened herself against the elevator wall, clutching her purse like a shield across her chest. Inca's tongue hung limply from the side of her mouth as she continued to pant and grin at Posh. My dog's expression can be interpreted as either, "Let's play," or, "Can I help you off with your skin?" depending on the individual. I find her expression endearing. But Posh didn't seem to share that opinion. We reached her floor, and Posh beat a hasty retreat from the elevator. "We're not in Kansas anymore," I whispered as the doors slid shut. Inca smacked her lips and grinned up at me, tongue sliding to the other side of her mouth. A scattered mess of paw prints littered the elevator floor beneath her. "Freakin' Stonehenge," I thought, rolling my eyes. It was going to be a long day. Our arrival at the office was greeted with much fanfare. The clients were thrilled to see Inca, and after the cold reception we'd received in the elevator from Posh, I felt Inca had redeemed herself. Maybe she'd be a good office dog after all. Visions of the two of us working together in perfect harmony danced through my head. These delusions wouldn't last long. Like a cold, hard slap in the face, reality was about to set in. The petting zoo continued to be a hit throughout the morning, right up until the toddler incident. A client's visiting 2-year-old son was immediately smitten with Inca. He showered her with love, repeatedly grabbing fistfuls of Inca's fur and burying his sticky face in her lush coat. Perhaps it was the toddler's high-pitched squeals or the fact my dog was leashed and trapped, but Inca finally had enough and released a deep-throated growl that needed zero interpretation. Oblivious to Inca's warning, the boy continued to stagger precariously towards her, arms akimbo, squealing in hot, drooly anticipation of their embrace. Inca issued a sharp warning bark as the boy stumbled toward her. Just as the child was about to descend, I scooped him up and returned him safely to his father's arms, apologies spilling from my lips. The father seemed nonplussed, waving the incident off, but I must admit the potential horror of that situation haunted me. Inca had always been patient with children, but even a patient, sweet-natured dog has her breaking point. After the toddler incident, I quarantined Inca behind the reception desk. The petting zoo was officially closed for the day. I glanced at the clock. It was only 11 a.m. I wondered if Starbucks made martinis. Just a thought, Howard Schultz. With nary a martini in sight, I decided some fresh air was in order and hustled Inca downstairs for a quick walk. On our way back, I stopped by our van to pick up some supplies. Surely I could balance a few boxes and Inca's leash, couldn't I? Gathering all the pluck and spunk we could muster, Inca and I retrieved the packages and headed to the elevator. There are several elevator options from the parking garage, and to my complete dismay, I took the wrong one. Instead of taking the elevator to the building lobby, I accidentally took the one that opened directly into the bank. The elevator doors slid open, and suddenly there we were, in the middle of the Union Bank. Inca strutted past me and into the bank like she owned the joint. Before I could move, the elevator doors slid shut. Horrified, I looked down at the leash in my hand. Instead of seeing my dog at the end of it, all I saw was the leather leash firmly wedged between the elevator doors, which meant on the other side of those doors my dog was alone in the bank. After a moment to process what was happening, aka wigging out, I dropped my packages on the floor and fell upon the elevator's control panel, frantically pressing the open door button. After what seemed like an eternity, the doors slid open to reveal Inca waiting calmly on the other side, Queen of the Union Bank. From my peripheral vision, I spotted the bank's security desk and knew all eyes were on me. An unchaperoned dog in a bank. That's normal, no problem, I told myself. Inca threw me a look that read, "Get your shit together, lady." Still gripping the leash, I propped open the elevator door with one leg and bent down to claw at the packages strewn across the elevator floor. I'm sure I looked like a crazy bag lady playing Twister alone in the elevator. Nice. I can't be sure, but I think I heard giggling coming from the security desk. They were probably taking bets on whether or not my little circus would make it to the lobby doors. Clutching the boxes, I regained my composure and headed towards the exit, Inca padding beside me. I was mere inches away from making my escape when my load shifted, and to my horror, a box slid from the top of the stack. I watched helplessly as it slammed against the glass doors with a deafening smack. The noise reverberated and echoed off the bank walls, sounding like a bomb had been detonated. I was too red-faced to look, but figured security probably had their guns trained on my back. Mustering what little pluck I had left in reserve, I bent to retrieve my package, but before I could reach it, a hand snaked out and snatched it up. I mumbled thank you and glanced up to find myself staring into the cool blue eyes of TV's own Nathan Fillion. "This is yours, I believe," he said, replacing the parcel on top of my stack. I was completely gobsmacked. As Nathan smiled and held the door open for us, I staggered past him, unable to take my eyes off his dashing boyish grin and brown feathered hair. I'm a huge fan, but before I could gush out my fangirl appreciation for his work, he breezed through the lobby and was gone. Was that really him? I asked Inka as we waited for an elevator. Inka merely panted and drooled. She seemed unimpressed. Maybe it was just someone who looked like Nathan Fillion. Perhaps the embarrassment I'd endured in the bank had made me feverish and I was imagining things. But if I had to conjure up a hero, who better to come to my rescue than Firefly's dashing Captain Malcolm Reynolds, right? I staggered into the first elevator that opened and dropped everything onto the floor. Inka grinned up at me and wagged her tail. It was business as usual for a working-class dog. Between toddler maulings and Nathan Fillion sightings, it had been a busy but unproductive Friday. My husband and I agreed that Take Your Dog to Work Day had been a complete bust. But it wasn't Inka who'd failed, it was me. I wasn't Stonehenge-worthy. My dog had acted on instinct throughout the day, while I'd ignored mine at every turn. Deep down, I knew that Inka would be far happier in her own backyard than pounding the mean streets of the concrete jungle. But I'd ignored my rational inner voice and forced Inka into a situation she wasn't suited for. In the future, when wine-fueled bright ideas pop into my head, I'll try to pump the brakes and listen to those instincts. My inner voice might be loud, abrasive, and kind of a killjoy, but she saved my ass more times than I can count. And when it comes to logical choices, she really is the best in show, a true working-class bitch. If you enjoyed this story, or you enjoy my podcast, please consider becoming my podcast patron. Just click the link on my Podbean page. And here is The Puppet Masters. I live with four men, so I'm pretty familiar with the penis. Everyone in my house has one but me and the dog. Frankly, I think she has penis envy, but I try not to judge. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on male anatomy, but after raising three boys, I've seen my fair share of jolly sticks. So when presented with an opportunity to see one live on stage, I didn't shy away. I figured I was more than prepared. But how does one really prepare for a 4-foot-long John Thomas? There are plenty of jokes I could make here, but I'm sure you're already filling in the blanks. My husband first heard about puppetry of the penis on NPR and thought it sounded like a hilarious stage show. Never one to shy away from bizarre forms of entertainment, he snapped up 4 tickets to the highly acclaimed touring production. The show, consisting of 2 Aussie puppeteers, would be in Portland for one night only at the Aladdin Theater. Naturally, I had questions. Was this a real puppet show? Were these puppets that look like penises, or penises dressed like puppets? Had the Muppets ever worked with them? Was this legal? And more to the point, did their mothers know how they made a living? My husband explained that the show was touted as the ancient Aussie art of genital origami and basically boiled down to 2 men on stage playing with their twigs and berries. Apparently, the duo had been quite popular, touring Australia, London, and most of the Western world. They'd appeared on The Tonight Show and had entertained A-listers like Hugh Grant, Elton John, and the Beckhams. This prompted more questions. Specifically, had the ancient Australians really considered this to be art? In the 1700s, Australia had been home to a penal colony, so perhaps this had been a way to pass time in prison. But honestly, how could playing with your junk entertain a man for hours? Wait, don't answer that. Ultimately, I became intrigued and decided if it was good enough for Vicky Bex, it was good enough for me. We had 4 tickets. The big question was who did we know that wouldn't be easily offended and also crazy enough to go with us? The answer was my sister and her husband. I could usually count on my sister to throttle up the crazy in any situation, and my brother-in-law was a man with a highly developed tolerance for absurd behavior. They were the perfect pair for this gig. Between us, we'd raised 4 boys. The Aussies couldn't possibly show us anything we hadn't seen before, right? The night of the event arrived, and I developed a slight case of nerves, which led to a lot more questions. Was this show considered pornography? Was it immoral? What would my fundamentalist neighbors think if they knew? Would there be a set, a plot, or musical numbers? But the most important question of the night, what does one have for dinner before seeing a penis puppet show? The answer was sausage, naturally. The only decent offering nearby was a German restaurant across the street. Our standards weren't very high. We just wanted a floor that wasn't sticky with cheap beer and vomit. Not an easy task in that particular part of town. Fortunately, the restaurant was bright and bustling, and best of all, the atmosphere wasn't steeped in stale cigarettes and depression. Our waiter announced the special of the day was a hearty Veerbort sausage served over a bed of sauerkraut. Considering the proximity to the theater, this is called playing to the crowd. We ordered four and a reasonably priced bottle of Liebfraumilch to wash it down. Although we didn't discuss the show we were about to see, I believe it was uppermost in our minds. More than once I caught my brother-in-law and husband wincing as they watched me slice into my sausage. Their problem, not mine, right? Weenies. Bellies full of Veerbort, we headed for the theater, grabbing another glass of wine in the lobby. The additional wine was probably a bad idea. I can see that now, but we were all a bit apprehensive, and the Liebfraumilch had done little to quell our nerves. The opening act, a female comedian, took the stage at 8 and worked the crowd into a comedic frenzy. After a full hour of jokes, we were primed for the show, full of anticipation, cheap wine, and sausages. At 9:15, the theater went dark, and a hush fell over the crowd as the penises prepared to take the stage. This was the moment we'd been waiting for. I gripped my sister's hand in mine, giggling like a schoolgirl. A low murmur rippled through the audience as the lights came up on stage, and the dramatic theme music from 2001 A Space Odyssey blasted through the auditorium. The excitement was mounting. I sensed the audience was on the edge of its collective seat. We were all eager to experience the majesty of penis puppets. Offstage, a fog machine pumped out layers of haze, which rolled across the stage and wafted into the waiting audience. Suddenly, a brilliant white light flashed across the stage, momentarily blinding the audience, as two men appeared on opposite sides of the stage. They were dressed in garish superhero capes and nothing else. Sharp titters of nervous laughter bounced through the audience as we took in the spectacle. Maybe spectacle is overstating it. I don't know why I was surprised by the sight of two naked men in capes and tennis shoes. After all, this was exactly what we'd come to see. But it was just so plain, so ordinary, so there. Perhaps I'd expected to be courted a tad before the full reveal. At the very least, a striptease. I blinked, my eyes searching the stage wildly. Surely there had to be more to this show. Backup dancers? A bouquet of flowers? Laser light show? A PowerPoint presentation, perhaps? But the stage was empty except for the two puppet masters from Australia. There they stood in all of their dubious glory. No props or gyrating dancers, just two naked men and their Don Johnsons. It did put one myth to rest. The size of the man has no correlation to the size of his assets. After the nervous guffaws and giggles died down, the duo began contorting themselves into various shapes. They twisted their joysticks into sailboats, hammocks, flying squirrels, and hamburgers, all of which received huge laughs. And for those wanting an up-and-close personal experience, two large TV screens on either side of the stage broadcast every detail in pixelated perfection. I could just imagine the lighting crew working overtime to ensure that the puppeteer's wing-dang-doodles were properly illuminated. I did have to wonder what else Aussies did for entertainment. This couldn't really be the pinnacle of Australian theatrical offerings, could it? As the show progressed, I began to grow restless. I missed the opening act. The comedian had been funny, entertaining, and clothed. Things the placid Pecker pair sadly lacked. I had to face facts. While the show might have sounded titillating, watching a grown man play with his tallywhacker on stage is actually pretty dull. After 10 minutes, it had become mundane. After 20, it was like watching paint dry. After 30 minutes, more wine was a necessity. Mercifully, the bar was open, and my sister and I headed back for reinforcements. 8 ounces of Chardonnay later, my sister and I suddenly got the joke. Not only did we see the humor in the show, we got pretty loud about it. The audience was a fairly boisterous bunch, but they had nothing on my sister, who was now yelling suggestions to the duo on stage. The atmosphere was almost carnival-like, so her near heckling seemed appropriate at the time. Not only did I encourage my sister, I hooted and howled along with her. Our husbands, both several drinks behind us, tried their best to shush us into submission, but to no avail. The giggles kept coming, unabated. My husband, now irritated and far too sober, did something that to this day he cannot fully explain. In an attempt to quiet us, he threw cold water on our party. Literally. In the darkened theater, my husband held his glass of water high overhead and proceeded to dump its entire contents into my lap. I gasped in shock as the cold wetness spread across my thighs, seeping into my new jeans. My sister and I were in complete shock. We stared at my husband, waiting for some explanation, but he merely shrugged his shoulders. Blinking at one another like two blind mice, my sister and I simultaneously burst into laughter, hooting like a pair of sailors on leave. Nothing was going to stop our party, not even a cold dousing of H2O. As the lights came up and we filed out of the theater, the other audience members gave me a wide berth, and with good reason. If you ever see a drunken, giggling woman with a wet crotch stain, you too should give her a wide berth. My sister called a few months later to tell me that Puppetry of the Penis was returning to the Aladdin soon. She wondered if my husband and I would like to go again. Naturally, I said yes. There is always a funny opening act and an open bar in the lobby. What more could one want? My only advice to those considering tickets: if you go with a sober husband, bring a good raincoat. Thanks so much for listening. If you like these stories or my podcast, please share and let me know. You'll find me on Twitter at Chris KK Aria, Pinterest, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Remember, it's Chris with a K. I'm always looking for fun stories to narrate, so if you're an author or writer with a story which fits the "Does This Happen to You?" theme, please contact me or comment on my Podbean page.